Brothers and sisters, we're ready to begin our second class. Our speaker is Brother Matt Norton. The theme for Brother Norton's classes this week is the life of Daniel. Today's class is entitled God or Man. Brother Norton.
Morning, my dear brothers and sisters. How are we all this morning? That's excellent to hear. Well, guess how far further on we are than yesterday, from chapter 2 to chapter 3. Guess how many years we've traversed just overnight. Have a guess. Can't go on till you guess. Yes, it's around about 18. There's a bit of conjecture about exactly how long it is, but you know, many people think it's around about 18 years, and it sort of coincides. Well, where's Daniel? 18 years. Where's Daniel? At the time when you're going to bow down to the image, was Daniel sick? This day, was Daniel sitting beside Nebuchadnezzar up on the platform like that? And he wasn't required to bow down? I don't think so. Where could Daniel have been? What could be the answer for this? And while you're thinking about that too, think about what it would be like for Nebuchadnezzar for 18 years. He's recalcitrant. He's stubborn. And sometimes he says sorry, but he doesn't want to give in. And he, for 18 years, has had to put up with the interpretation of Daniel that he was only the head of gold and he wanted to be the head of everything. He wanted to be the entire image of gold. And yet he had to submit to Daniel's advice. And he loved Daniel too, there's no doubt about that. So he's got Daniel on one side in one ear saying, Nebuchadnezzar, you're a wise administrator. And I know it's hard for you to look back on your history and look at Nimrod's kingdom and Babel and to have to submit to that dispersion. I know you want unity, but you can't have unity without God. And unfortunately for you, it's the God of the Jews. And that must have been difficult for Nebuchadnezzar to understand and to accept, because on the other side, he's got his Jewish, his Babylonian advisors, you know, the wise men, and they're in his ear too, saying, it's nothing. It was a fluke. It was some weird Jewish Jedi mind trick that he guessed what your thoughts were in your mind and that he understood the dream. And anyway, who's to say, Nebuchadnezzar, you can't circumvent that interpretation? You can't change it. Why shouldn't you be the head of gold and the breast and arms of gold and the belly and thighs of gold and the legs of gold and the feet of gold? No stone will ever take this kingdom out. And it must have been hard for Nebuchadnezzar wrestling with that all the time. And he's a great God king, and he wants to be God. This chapter is all about chapter 2. This chapter is Nebuchadnezzar saying, that's it. I'm going to predict the future. I'm not having the interpretation. And it's highly likely at this stage what gives him an even more motivation to do it is that it may coincide with the last siege of Jerusalem at the time of the rebellion of Zedekiah, when Nebuchadnezzar goes over there and he takes the temple apart brick by brick. So if it happens at the beginning, because the siege is about 2.5 years, if it happens at the beginning, he sets up this huge image and he thinks to himself, this is great. I'm going over there. They can't stop me. I'm not going to listen to the interpretation of Daniel anymore. I'm going to go over there and I'm going to take Jerusalem off the map. And when we come back, we can all dance around this image and it'll be the central focus of the celebrations of overcoming that Jewish God. And if it happened, and then Nebuchadnezzar goes and besieges Jerusalem, but if it happened at the end, even more impetus for Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel may still be taking some, you know, under official capacity back there in Jerusalem and arranging some more affairs. He's not there, evidently. And his three friends have to stand together by themselves, united, without Daniel. Daniel did in chapter 1. Now they've got to do it by themselves. And Nebuchadnezzar, if it is at the end of the time of the siege, is even more bold. Now there's nothing that can stop me from extending my kingdom out for another 1,000 years. Bel will give me immortality. Can you see him thinking about this sort of thing? You know it's how it is. I'm the head of gold. They should worship me. And I'm going to resist the temptation of, the interpretation of Daniel. Just have a look at chapter 47, please, brothers and sisters. Have a look at Isaiah 47. This is what Nebuchadnezzar was doing right at this moment. And this is Babylon all over. They don't want to submit. They can't stand the interpretation that they're going to have to give their dominion to another, particularly to God. They despise it. In verse 7 of Isaiah 47, it says this. You said, and this is Nebuchadnezzar, right at this minute, this is Daniel 3, I shall be a mistress forever. This is what they said. This is what Nebuchadnezzar was trying to do. And over in verse 10, God says, this is what happened with you. You felt secure in your wickedness. You said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge led you astray. You said in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. Whose refrain is that? That's God's refrain, punctuating these chapters of Isaiah. God's the one who says, I am, and there is no one else besides me who can save. And now Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon saying it. They think they're like God. And any wonder that when you go to Daniel, back to Daniel 3, that chapter 4 is at his most proud, because he gets humiliated in this chapter and he still doesn't want to give up. He's walking around the kingdom of Babylon thinking, every single brick's got my name impressed in it. This is my place. And he still doesn't want to give it up. And he sees the vision of the tree cut down and he thinks, what's this about? Daniel tells him, Nebuchadnezzar, it's to you. You've got to let it go. And evidently at this time, he must have been treating the poor and the weak badly, out of anger and frustration and spite. Because Daniel says, here's my advice to you. Break off your sins by being a little bit more humble and treating the weak and the poor nicer. And so for 12 months, he tried to do it. For 12 months, his pride didn't get the better of him. And he accepted Daniel's interpretation that he would only be the head of gold. He'd have to give way to silver and brass and iron. But it was hard. And one day he woke up again and he looked around and he thought, there's no way this could ever fall. Look at how big this place is. And I built it for my glory. This is Babylon the Great, which I built. And boom, God takes him out again. This is what Daniel 3 is about. And now Nebuchadnezzar, in the vein of Isaiah's forecast, is attempting to predict the future. And he feels like he's ready to sit the God test. You know how you do a whole, few semesters of study and you get educated and you've got to go and sit a test, right? I hate tests. But what's the God test? All the wannabe gods come into the hall and all the papers are there. What's the God test? You want to be a god, you got to pass this exam. It's pretty easy, like Sam said about, forgiveness. In some respects, it's simple. Just write the answers down, simple. But in other respect, it's impossible, except if you're a god. Anybody know what the God test is? That's what it is. Simple. Just write down the future. We'll close the book, put in a little time capsule, come back later and see if you got it right. You can be a God too. Have a look at Isaiah. This is what Isaiah talks about here. It's the God test. And it's really, really exciting because in Isaiah 41, here's one section. And it goes through these chapters of Isaiah where God really sets out his credentials that he is God because he can predict the future. And the basis and the future prediction that he makes is all time. So he says, 21, Isaiah 41, verse 21. Set forth your case, says Yahweh. Bring your proofs, says the king of Jacob. Let them, the other would-be gods, let them bring them and tell us what is to happen. Tell us the former things. Make sense of what's gone before, that we may consider them, that we may know their outcome, or declare to us the things to come. Tell us what is to come hereafter, that we may know that you are God's. There it is. Tell us what is to come hereafter, that we may know that you are God's. Does anybody know what the prediction is of God that proves that he is the God? I mean, he makes many prophecies in the Bible, but there's one big prediction he makes. Does anybody know what that is? Well, it's in Isaiah there, yes. What is the big prediction he makes that the whole world has to finally acknowledge and go, because of that, we have to say, you are the God. You're the only one. What's the prediction? Yes, it's the safe passage. It's the God who can negotiate the safe passage of Israel through the nations, that they're going to come through unscathed, like the burning bush. There'll be fire all around them, and yet it's not burned. And like Isaiah 43 says, just have a look at that. In verse 2, though you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned. God makes that prediction about Israel. And of course, we know they got thrown into the Holocaust precisely because the natural side of Israel bowed down and worshipped the gods of the other nations. And they were cast into God's furnace and they were burned up. But the point of this chapter here in Isaiah is God says, I'm the true God. I'll tell you, I'll do something absolutely miraculous because it's the least likely nation that would make it. It's the Jewish nation. Everybody hates them. Everybody wants a piece of them. Everybody wants to erase them. But I say they're going to survive. And guess what Nebuchadnezzar, in setting up this image of gold, was saying? I'm going to be the God. I'm going to sit the God test. I'll predict the future, and here's the future. I'm going to destroy Israel. I'm going to wipe it off the face of the earth, and I'm going to erase their God. And so there's the exact antithesis of what's going on here. And Nebuchadnezzar loses out on this day. It's absolutely incredible what goes on in Daniel chapter 3. And we can see now, it's not just some Sunday school lesson that we learn at Sunday school, though we do. But this is such a massive lesson for us because this is what the world is about. This is what the whole universe is about here on this little globe that we're a part of. And we're blessed to be able to see it. And we've got to believe that our God can save us. And I think to myself sometimes, like you probably thought to yourself, God can't save me. Who do you think you are? What do you mean God can't save you? You're nothing. Absolutely nothing. You think you're better than Israel? Everybody wanted to take Israel down. If God can save Israel, he can save you. So the God test that he sat was, I'll predict the future, and he absolutely wins. And so let's have a look at this here. So the whole question is, who are you going to serve? You want to serve the king that wants to be God, but he doesn't even know what's going to happen tomorrow with his kingdom? Or do you want to serve the real God? And just in keeping with this too, just another idea, because this is, think about how Babylon is such a travesty and tries always to mimic God, as you would expect somebody or something or some political system that always wants to be God. Who else made an image that was to be worshipped? Yeah, so Babylon in the New Testament, right? Remember they set up the image, it had the number and name of a man, and said everyone's got to worship the image. If you don't, you'll be, you know, you're going to be killed. You know that. That's what they always do. But who made the image in the beginning? Before that, I'm talking about God himself. Didn't God make an image of himself in the beginning? Yeah, he made Adam. God made an image. But isn't it extraordinary? What was that image meant to do? Was it meant to turn around and worship self? It was meant to worship him and reflect him. And so you have these ideas going on in this chapter here. All these contrary ideas. So where's the image set up? It's in Dura, in the land of Shinar, because we know it's in the land of Shinar from chapter 1, where Babylon was, but he's found another little plain, evidently in chapter 3, called Dura, whatever that is and wherever that is and whatever that means, in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And so he sets up this big image. And what is this image? What was it? Did it have Nebuchadnezzar's face on it? Was it an exact replica of what he saw in the dream, you know, 18 years before, which now he's trying to object to? Was it a Babylonian god, or was it like, was it, and I sort of think it's like this, it's this post-truth, post-modernism time of Babylon, the spirit of Babylon. You think about it, it's a cunning stroke of genius, because you could have your own gods still. You could worship any god you wanted to in Babylon. They allow that. It's postmodernism. And they're all true. And it doesn't matter which one's true, post-truth. This is the time. But it's a stroke of genius, because Nebuchadnezzar at least requires you can have your own gods, but you've also got to worship this one. And he's got this central focus around which he wants to remember, bring back the dispersion of Babel. He wants them to unite. So for Jewry, for every nation that was there centered in Babylon, this is the most impressive statue that any Jew would have ever seen. And it's the largest crowd of dignitaries. I mean, look what it says. For goodness sake, the king Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image. So this is really big. This is highbrow. And for any other witnesses from, you know, the plebs that were there, this would have been some exciting ceremony to be part of. Come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And I guess you should have, if you haven't done it, you should be going through there. Nebuchadnezzar had set up, Nebuchadnezzar had set up, Nebuchadnezzar had set up, all the way through. And the other one about the burning fiery furnace, the burning fiery furnace. The burning fiery furnace. Look at this. It's the largest crowd ever, representing as many nations imaginable, united around a single project, which has got a religious tinge to it. And they even had a fiery furnace, just like Babel did. And it's funny, you know, they're going to throw people into the burning fiery furnace. Nebuchadnezzar never made the furnace and said, oh, guess what, everyone? I've got a new torture instrument. It's going to be so fun throwing people into that. Like, does anybody know what the furnace was for? And? Melt what? Exactly. Here, I'll read this to you. Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 3 says, the crucible is for silver and the furnace is for gold. So where do you think that image came from? Right? It didn't just, you know, go abracadabra. That's what it came out of, the fiery furnace. But the great thing about fiery furnaces is they do have a dual application. You can torture people in them if you want to. So it's fantastic. It's a great thing to have in the backyard. And it's exactly like the European project today. And I wouldn't be surprised. I know it's going to happen. The Bible's pretty clear about it. The further we go on, and the more problems, especially they have with immigration and in the Islamic issues in Europe, we're going to see more and more influence of the Roman Catholic Church, more and more influence of, you can worship any god you want, of course you can. We don't want to be have a phobia about any religion, but there's one religion you've got to pay homage to, and it will be, I believe, in the Western European civilization, the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, look at this. There's no doubt about it. This is for people who don't read their Bibles hardly. Anyone can see that. Anybody can see it. This is what's going to happen today. Europe will have this unifying force to it. And so, as we said, it's a stroke of genius of Nebuchadnezzar. There's no doubt about it. He expected all the officials to take this spirit of Babylonia, or this worship, this central unifying religion, back to all quarters of to Babylon and to the empire, because he wanted to keep them together. First of all, that's what he was going to do. Also, what else do you think it is? What else do you think this is a clever stroke of genius, requiring everybody to bow down and worship this image was for? What do you think the other application or the other reason that Nebuchadnezzar did it, or at least another one? Yeah, so yes, to unite the people, to get them really excited and proud and patriotic about Babylonia. Probably had, you know, I don't know what their flag was like, probably blue with those 12 stars around it. I don't know. Yes. Because he thinks to himself, head of gold sympathizes, or the interpretation of Daniel sympathizes, right. Who wants me to leave my kingdom for the breast and arms of silver? There must be sympathizers, probably amongst the Jews, almost, you know, it's got to be all amongst the Jews. But I know if I command everybody to worship this, because everybody can see that this is in direct contradiction to what Daniel's interpretation was, anyone that doesn't worship this are going to be sympathetic to that interpretation. And more likely, the rust and that type of influence in my kingdom that will bring about its destruction, or at least be a danger to my kingdom going down into generation after generation. And so that's what he does. And so he commands everybody to worship this image. He puts it up high on a pedestal where everybody can look up to it, and he commands it to be worshipped. And we know that whether it's the Babylonian god, whether it's Nebuchadnezzar, in the end, it's a worship of self. Of that, there's no doubt. And you know what the gods of the world are like. Everything that takes up your time and your money can be a god. And Nebuchadnezzar didn't care about that. If he was the god they had to worship, and he was, you could worship yourself. And if you went to the god shop to buy a god, which I'm glad I don't have to, because I'd choose the wrong one. You think about the gods that you can choose from in this world. You know, some people choose education, some people choose cars and money, some people choose like travel, some people just want experiences in life, some people choose toned fit bodies, for example. Not that one's popular around here, I can tell, but but you know what I mean. It doesn't matter what there is, you spend your time on it and you will serve it. So let's have a look at the types of gods that are out there to choose from. It's in Isaiah chapter 40. These chapters of Isaiah are really amazing. So God tells us the difference between the gods. And you imagine if there's a salesman selling gods. Isaiah 46. Here's a salesman selling two different gods, and God lays these choices out for us. And he says, Bel bows down, Nebo stoops. See the Babylonian gods? They can be anything you want to be, want them to be. Their idols are on beasts and livestock. These things you carry and are borne as burdens on weary beasts. You put a god on a cart and a beast carries it and drags it along, and the beast gets tired and the stupid god can't even impart any strength to make the beast like giddy up. They stoop, they bow down together. They cannot save the burden. What's the purpose for worshipping a god, by the way? My mate used to have on, a guy I used to go to school with, have on the back of his car, surfing is my religion. And he served it pretty well, but it could never save him. The only purpose for worshipping a god is that it can save. Why would you worship a god and turn to worship a god that can't save? That's ridiculous. They can't save the burden, but themselves go into captivity. So they're carting their really precious god along. The horses, the asses that are dragging along, they get tired. So everybody says, all right, we've got to have a rest. The gods need a break. And then they hear this, oh, coming over. I mean, that's probably racists do that. I don't know what happens in postmodern society. But they come over the hill. There's a tribe of, aggressive, whatever they are, they're invaders. And they look at the god and they go, get up, go and get him. And the god just sits there. And look what it says. They go into captivity. The god can't even save itself. Why are you worshipping it? This is crazy. And then in verse 7, if you do happen to save your God from, you know, certain captivity, verse 7 says, you got to lift it onto your shoulders and carry it. And then you set it in its place, and then it just sits there. It doesn't even go. It cannot move from place to place. If one cries to it, it doesn't answer or save him from trouble. So honestly, who wants a God like that? Look at the difference between that and our God. So I'd be scared if I went to the God shop to choose the God, because I'd choose the wrong God every time. I get kaleidoscope eyes and get all excited about all different things. I go, oh, that's the one I want. And I delude myself into believing that it could save me, and it couldn't. And I'd make the wrong choice and I'd choose the wrong God. But thankfully, our God doesn't leave us with that choice. Our God chooses us. And that makes all the difference. You're walking along the street and you didn't see God and say, hey, I might have that God there. That God looks good. I'll choose the God of Israel. It didn't happen like that at all, brothers and sisters. You were walking down the street and our God chose you. He said, I'll have her for my kingdom. I'll have him. That's how it works. That's how God says it works. We like to think that we're the arbiters of our own future, but it's not that simple. This is the God of heaven. He makes us. He's powerful. He tells the future. Look at it. Look how beautifully the words here bear this out. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, verse 3, all the remnant of the house of Israel who have been born by me from before your birth and carried from the womb. It's almost God was there at our conception. He was there when we were given birth. At the time of our birth, he took us out. Even to your old age, I am he, and to grey hairs, I will carry you. I have made and I will bear, I will carry and I will save. That's the God I want. I want the God that chooses me. And so when we get tempted to bow down and worship the gods of our own choosing, our own making, think about the difference. Think about the contrast. Because these men sure did. And look what happens. Go back to Daniel. Everybody's there. There's no doubt about it at all. Everybody's there watching. And the commands made by Nebuchadnezzar, who at the time that you hear, you know, the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe. And apparently when you look up expositors, these aren't all Babylonian musical instruments. This is diversity. This is multiculturalism. Nebuchadnezzar's included everybody. You are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And look, we have one just here. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples with that incentive heard the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar set up. And the consciences of those three men, you imagine, they're standing there, everybody just prostrates themselves. Prostrates, I always get the word wrong, sorry. Fall down. And the pressure on their shoulders just to go, just bow down. It's not going to be, 10 seconds, it doesn't even matter. Their consciences say, no, I'm not going to do it. And you're one of the ones that have bowed down, you're looking up, just squinting out of one eye, and you're thinking, oh, this is going to be good. This is our great God now. This is the spirit of Babylon. You wait. Probably fire is going to come from its eyes and wipe these guys out. We better spread out from around them. Something bad's going to happen. Nothing happens. And you have to think about it even later that night when they get home. And they're talking to their families, a lot of chatter around the town of Babylon. And they say, can you believe it? Nebuchadnezzar had all these commands. He set up the God. We're sacking Jerusalem. We've sacked it now. And that lump of metal stood there and did nothing when these three Jews defied everything that we stood for. It must have been disappointing for them. And it didn't go unnoticed, that's for sure, because look at verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. It's the same idea in chapter 6 when Daniel was maliciously accused at the time he was thrown into the lion's den. This is how malicious it was. And they declared to the king Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree. And he did make a decree. Look what happens this day with Nebuchadnezzar. We'll go to the charge in just a sec. Nebuchadnezzar makes all these commands this day and they all come to nothing. It's in some ways it's entertaining, in some ways it's frustrating if you see it from Nebuchadnezzar's point of view. He says, you are commanded to do this. Verse 10 says, they say, didn't you make a command? Aren't you the king? He's angry and he says, right, bring them here. I'll deal with this. And then we know later he goes berserk and he says, right, heat it up, keep it going, stoke that fire. And we realize, you know, it even kills the innocent soldiers who throw them in. And then he gets exasperated when they're walking around in the fiery furnace and he demands that they come out and come over to him. And then in verse 28, when he finally admits that it's not his day, he attempts to save face by saying, don't blaspheme this God. And that's the only command at the end of the day that actually works. It's the only command at the end of the day that anybody listens to. And so he gets them over there, and here's the charge. This is what they charge the Jews with. Now, you're Nebuchadnezzar, and you get these sniveling, these sycophants who, you know, profess to serve you, but they're in it for themselves. And they say to Nebuchadnezzar, you know, these guys are Jews. And you know how anti-Semitic we are. And you know what? They're only here because you gave them jobs. And they're leaders in Babylon, and they're disrespecting you. Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar. You put them in charge, and they're not listening to a word you have to say. They refuse to serve our Babylonian gods, and they refuse to worship this image. Didn't you make the image? So Nebuchadnezzar's pride has really been appealed to. And he doesn't disappoint. He does not disappoint. But he must love these men too because he gives them a second chance. But then in verse 13 it says, Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage. It's bad to be angry because people get hurt when you're angry. I mean, brothers, you know what it's like to be angry? Anger's not good. But there's something humorous about watching someone who's really, really mad. Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commands that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. And so they brought these men near before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar basically says, look, I'm going to give you a second chance. Is it true? And he's affronted that they don't take a step back and say, oh, yeah, sorry, we misunderstood the cues and things. We didn't quite get it. They just said, look, O King Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this so be, our God whom we serve, one, he's able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. He could do that. And two, and this is the catching point, you've got no power at all because he will deliver us out of your hand. And they just say it flatly to him. No apologies. And it doesn't mean they're not sitting there shaking like this, adrenaline, fear and faith all mixed together. But they say it. If God wants to, do what you like, Nebuchadnezzar. We're not bowing down. You could throw us into there. God could get us out if he wants to. They're not certain of that. But they know this, and this is absolutely certain. Doesn't matter what happens today, we're going to be delivered out of your hand. Either through death in the furnace, you can't do a thing to us then. Or if we come out, you can't touch us. Well, this doesn't go down too well with Nebuchadnezzar. Let me tell you that. Look what it says. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Nebuchadnezzar. You know, I get my kids to do it. I should have taken a photo. Like, like hold their breath and do that really crazy face so the veins on your neck stick up and your ears go pink and purple. That's what happened with Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, the word there, fury, have a guess what the word fury means. This is really good because you get the idea of what the real metaphor is here. What does fury mean?
Burning.
Yes, it means to be hot, like really, really hot. How hot? 7 times hot. That's how. You know Nebuchadnezzar hasn't been this angry for 18 years. He is really filthy at the moment. And he's apoplectic and he's going off the Richter, and the furnace is a reflection of his anger, which makes it even better for us because we walk around and go, oh yeah, it's a nice kid's story, but we're not going to get thrown into a fiery furnace, are we? Don't have to. You go outside in the world and you don't bow down to their image. You don't walk according to their doctrines because they're proselyzing all the time. You can have your doctrine, but you've got to agree with them. You can have your God, but you've got to bow down to their gods as well. If you don't bow down to their gods, what do you get? You get people screaming in your face. You have Antifa all over your news, everywhere, chucking milkshakes on people. It's not getting stopped. Screaming at people that just disagree with them. In their face, red hot anger. That's the fiery furnace today. That's the persecution today. The expression of his face was changed. He was full of fury. It changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And the contrast here is simply amazing because he's the one that gets changed. They get thrown into the fiery furnace and they come out unharmed. Nothing has changed about these men. And the furnace is heated 7 times more hot than it should have been. Whatever that means, it just means this is dangerous. And he orders some of the mighty men to throw them in, and in they go, and the king's command was so urgent. Where does it say that the king's command? See verse 22, because the king's order was urgent and the furnace was overheated. That word urgent is the same as in chapter 2, verse 15, when Arioch explains to Daniel that the king's command to kill all the wise men is urgent because he was that mad. 18 years it's been since he was this mad. He does not want to be only the head of gold. You have to feel for Nebuchadnezzar. This is a fight for his life. This is a fight for everything he believes in. If you've ever preached the truth to somebody, they don't want to let go. They don't want to let go. And they get angry. So the flame of the fire killed those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We know what happened. In they go, and they get thrown in bound, but then they start walking. And there's a fourth one in there, an angel, representation of God, whatever is in there. There's an angel in there with them. What's interesting about that? That they're walking in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. They went in bound. The only things that were destroyed were the things that bound them. If you want to link that to mortality, you can. But, you know, they're walking around like this in the fiery furnace. I don't suppose there's much room in there to go. And Nebuchadnezzar's looking in. He says, what's going on? How many did we put in? 3, sir. 3? Well, there's 4 in there. And he makes this command, like, come out. And I can imagine going, yeah, no, I'm just kidding. I'm not coming out yet. It's getting cold in here. You know? So, sorry, it's my silly brain. I know I'm smug about this, but Nebuchadnezzar, this was his day. His day. And they're ruining his day. What does that remind you of? Here's Nebuchadnezzar. There's the furnace of Babylon. And how ironic, Nebuchadnezzar says, come out. What does that remind you of?
Lazarus.
Yeah? What about in relation to Babylon, though? Come out. Yeah, isn't it ironic, the king of Babylon saying, come out. That's a Revelation chapter 18 and verse 4. There's an irony there. He's echoing the call of God to come out of Babylon to them. It's really incredible what's going on. Everything's going wrong for Nebuchadnezzar. God's turned it all on its head. He's the only God that can predict the future. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't even know which way is up or down. Come out and come here. And so they come out, and the satraps and the prefects, all of these high council here with Nebuchadnezzar, it says, they see. They're gathered together, you know, against the Son of God. They're gathered together, and they saw that the fire had no power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads weren't even singed. Their cloaks weren't harmed. They didn't even smell like fire. The whole thing's utterly amazing. So Nebuchadnezzar answers and says, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who had sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command." Now, it's hard to believe that he's so contrite about this. He's gone from just 7 times more angry than he's probably ever been, so determined in his hatred against the Jews and the Jewish nation and the Jewish God, to instantly admitting that the king's command had been set aside because that these men would rather serve their God than worship any other. And then he makes this decree that any people or nation or language that speaks anything against... Oh, by the way, I should mention as well, yes, I will mention, when he tells them to come out, this is, I wanted you to see this, when he tells them to come out and come here, he calls them servants of the Most High God. He calls them the servants of the Most High God. Does anybody know when that term first occurs? Yes, it's Melchizedek. He says it 4 times about being the servant of the Most High God. And that was in connection with another defeat of Babylon. So Nebuchadnezzar, when he calls them out and he calls them, he acknowledges defeat because he's calling their God the same title that the priest of that God had at the defeat of their ancient city of Babylon once more. Amraphel, king of Shinar. And Nebuchadnezzar's acknowledging defeat. That's why I love him. He can say sorry. He's better than me. You've got to squeeze sorry out of me. But he says, okay, I get it. I give up. And then he says, I'll make this decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses made dunghills. And again, where's that reference from? You'll be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made dunghills. Why did he say that same threat of punishment? Remember, this chapter's all about chapter 2. This is why this chapter's here. Yes, remember, if you don't give me the dream's details and then the interpretation, I'll tear you limb from limb. And I'll make your houses dunghills. So Nebuchadnezzar says it here again and he refers back to it because obviously, reluctantly, he's at least publicly accepting that interpretation of Daniel 2. He's at least acknowledging and saying, okay, I get it. You're saying I'm just going to be the head of gold and there's nothing I can do to predict the future that I can make this whole image of gold and continue my empire. And so I'm going to make that decree now in acknowledgement of that. No one's allowed to say anything against this God. And Nebuchadnezzar had set this entire day up to say everything he possibly could against that God. And now he's repented, he's gone back. But you'll notice that it's still the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's still the God of Daniel. It's not his God yet. That's for chapter 4. When finally God gets him, he squeezes him, he makes him see the beast that he actually is, and finally then he acknowledges God. He accepts Yahweh as his own God. I find that absolutely incredible. It must have been hard for him. It must have been so difficult. But Nebuchadnezzar, he turns, he puts his head down, and he accepts that he needs to make a decree that the only God that can predict the future is the God of the Jews. It's a marvelous little turn and twist into the story of Daniel.